Today on Wings. As of 2022, Juneteenth is a U.S. federal holiday. First celebrated by black communities in Texas, it marks June 19, 1865, when Union troops arrived at the port of Galveston to enforce Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. While Americans celebrate that enslaved people were freed, many refuse to hear the cruel facts of slavery or allow them to be taught. The late Marion E. Barnes was a storyteller, author, historian, child advocate, and black community leader in Austin, Texas. This week and next, you will hear her read a story nobody would publish.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Wings proudly presents Wade in the Water by storyteller Marion Barnes. She begins with a preface about the story's history.
Wade in the Water is based on the lives of people who once lived. I learned their stories by talking with formerly enslaved persons during my childhood, and with elderly members of my family, and by consulting the library records of the United States government-sponsored interviews with formerly enslaved people conducted by writers in the 1930s. Perhaps because Wade in the Water is not a pretty story, its path to the public has been obstructed. Although written originally for Talk That Talk, an anthology of African American storytelling, it was rejected by the publisher's editor. Subsequently taped to be broadcast during Black Heritage Month, the producer of the program for which it was intended refused to air the story. She said it made slavery seem too cruel. When a series of attempts to find a publisher failed, I decided to include Wade in the Water in a self-published anthology. Surprisingly, respected reviewers advised that it be excluded rather than risk alienating readers. What underlies the resistance to presenting Wade in the Water? To say it makes slavery seem too cruel is not plausible, since the story does not portray slavery to be nearly so cruel as it actually was. And readers should not be alienated by a depiction of life in the era of the American slavocracy unless the depiction conflicts with information, ideas, and ideals with which the reader is comfortable. I believe that to be the case, having encountered Americans of every hue who accept the highly sanitized version of the American slavocracy that is generally put forth. That is, the institution of slavery, though misguided, evolved during that era because of the country's developmental needs and the cultureless state of captured Africans. Also, captives received civilizing benefits from exposure to Western culture that outweighed the loss of freedom and abuse of human rights. Believers of this myth are disturbed when it's pointed out that captured Africans came from a part of Africa where a successful smallpox vaccine was being used. Not until 1796 would Dr. Edward Jenner become the first Western physician to develop a similar vaccine. They are further disquieted by evidence that ancestors of the captives possessed knowledge and technological skills in astronomy exceeding that of 20th century Western scientists, and by evidence that much of the progress of modern civilization rests upon the inventions, discoveries, and spiritual leadership of the captives and their descendants. Such people are equally distressed facing the reality of slavery in America, for which there is no historical parallel. Never before nor since has the enslavement of a people included the systematic destruction of their history, culture, languages, communities, families, and personal self-esteem as implemented by Americans. The bestiality of members of the master class is also without precedent. In the instruments and forms of torture devised, in enslaving their own children, in multiple incestuous unions with their children and grandchildren, whom they customarily enslaved or sold, in the attempt to legally dehumanize the enslaved population, in barbaric lynchings that were still occurring almost daily long after freedom had been proclaimed. Newspapers advertised lynchings in advance. Crowds came from afar on chartered trains. Victims were roasted over slow fires and their bodies mutilated. In addition, bodies were often cannibalized. People hoarded body parts as souvenirs, and photographs of lynched, mutilated bodies were sold as picture postcards. Well beyond the 1920s, lynchings were still being tallied. Yearly totals were publicized along with the gross national product and other national records. Although Wade in the Water does not emphasize the most heinous aspects of the institution of slavery, its portrayal of life during those times is jarringly at odds with the popular concept of a nearly benign slavocracy. And for many Americans, such a portrayal is unsettling. Historians have largely settled the problem by creating the widely accepted version of the era of slavery. Educators and students have followed suit by accepting that version without questions. Afro-Americans deal with the concept of the American slavocracy in different ways, most of which reject reality. Some romanticize slavery and the survival behavior of that time. Many do not want to remember their history. In my own family, there was icy resistance to any attempt to probe the past. Most of the African-American young children and teenagers I have encountered in traveling across the country have been taught virtually nothing of their history by their families, community organizations, or schools. I meet young people who do not know what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did, or who Malcolm X was, or what types of music African Americans have given the world. And they generally know nothing about the enslavement of their ancestors. Children of most ethnic groups are taught their special culture and history by their families and in community settings. The reason this custom is not widespread among Afro-Americans can perhaps be discerned from an expression made by many Afro-Americans during the television dramatization of Roots. "I don't want to see what happened back then. It's too painful. We need to forget about all that." Nothing could be further from the truth. We need to remember all of our history. The legacy of slavery imprints upon the life of every African American from birth to death. Forgetting the past means living with the imprint and not knowing what caused it, nor how to counteract it or benefit from it as the need may be. We need to remember. An estimated 100 million Africans were kidnapped from their homeland and sold into captivity. And it is believed by many historians that of that number, more than 30 million were slaughtered or died of maltreatment or disease. We need to give tongue to their every wound. The American Holocaust of enslaved Africans lasted nearly 300 years. It is impossible to number the millions of men, women, and children who were whipped, tortured, hanged, butchered, and roasted during those centuries. We need to remember. The death-dealing afterglow of the Holocaust in which we now live continues to claim lives daily, directly and indirectly. We need to remember. We need to remember. We need to remember. Wade in the Water. Queenie was really scared. Marse Johnson had sent for her, and she had found him here with Marse Joss Platt from the next plantation down the road. They were laughing and talking about a price for her like she wasn't even there. Mas Josh rubbed his thick, heavy, hairy hands all over her 10-year-old child's body, just showing the first slight signs of coming womanhood. Queenie's frightened eyes stretched wide and filled with water. "Ain't nothing to her, John. The money you asking for her is way out of line. Look here, boy, I didn't send for you. You come to me asking about her. I know, but I can see she's so little she can't be much use to nobody around here. It'll be years before she'll be any real use to you. And even then, she's built little, so she ain't never gonna be no strong worker. But you take me, I'm a single man. I'm gonna need somebody to run my house for me again pretty soon. And I'm thinking this young is young and good, and I can train her my way. Like you trained Maybelle a few bears back, huh? That what's the matter? Maybelle getting a little too old for your liking? Johnson's bawdy laughter filled the room. 'Tain't that exactly. Maybelle ain't even 20 years old yet, but seem like she always feeling poly nowadays. She can't do nothing much no more. She ain't got no strength, no life like she used to have. I figure it'll be all she can do to help train a new one. Well, listen, ain't but 10, and you squawking about the price, you old hound dog. For what you got in mind, she'd be cheap at twice what I'm asking. Queenie's throat felt like it would burst. Tears were rolling down her agitated, chocolate-colored face. Get out of here, gal, Johnson shouted at her impersonally. Juan, get! Queenie bolted blindly from the room, straight into the arms of a shadow that slipped off the wall, and became the cook who hugged the child fiercely, then hurried down the hall. From the moment Queenie had been summoned from the vegetable patch where she and her twin, Lil King, were working, the intelligence system among the enslaved people on the plantation had operated intensely and flawlessly as it always did. All over the South, behind vacant stares and blank, impassive faces of enslaved black men and women, who built roads, constructed buildings, laid rails, hewed lumber, shined shoes, made beds, washed clothes, nursed babies, drove carriages, weeded gardens, picked cottons, tended children, were eyes and ears that missed nothing, and minds that keenly interpreted the words, behaviors, and thoughts of the white master class. Now, throughout the silent big house, invisible black ears had heard everything, and lips whispered the news to enslaved houseworkers who had not heard. Moments later, a short, stout, enslaved woman stepped onto the back porch of the big house, carrying a laundry basket filled with wet clothes. She was called Hap Hat, shortened from Happy Hattie, a name she had earned because of her constant, lusty singing. Walking toward the clotheslines, Hap Hat felt the eyes of field hands boring into her. Veiled beneath the sun hats, hidden behind corn stalks, innocently looking across the land, their eyes watched her, waiting for her message, waiting to be told what was happening to Queenie in the big house. Hap Hat set her basket on the ground, withdrew a clothespin, and pinning a shirt on the line, she began to sing mournfully. Without a father, without a mother, without a sister, Lord, or a brother, what a mean world to live in. Lord, I've got to live here until I die. Hap Hat's song electrified the field hands. Mad Dog Platt was buying Queenie just as he had bought Maybelle. Poor Maybelle, pitiful now, broken, sick, and old before her time. It would be worse for Queenie. She was younger than Maybelle had been, and Hap Hat's song had said without a brother, which meant Platt wasn't buying King. Queenie was going to be separated from her twin. Spontaneously, the field hands began to moan their anguish in harmony, then to mournfully intersperse their moaning harmony with the sad refrain sung by Hap Hat. venting their grief because tragedy was striking the child who belonged to all of them. The song and its sorrowful message traveled through the air from one field of workers to another, and from plantation to plantation, until virtually every captive in the county knew what was happening to Queenie. The story of Queenie and her twin was well known to most of them. Their mother had died when they were born. Johnson, the plantation owner who had fathered them, had tried to sell the babies. Unable to do so, he had let them grow up in the quarters for the enslaved. No one had ever named the children. Cared for, loved, and waited on by all around, they were facetiously called Lil' King and Lil' Queen, which evolved into King and Queenie. Inside the big house, Queenie was crying. "He gonna sell me, Cookie. He gonna sell me, sure," she sobbed. "And they ain't said nothing about Lil' King. He gonna sell just me." "You hush, Lil' Queen," the cook said. She wiped Queenie's face with her apron, then pulled her close. "It'll be all right. Don't you fret." Queenie strained away from the cook's ample, smothering bosom to peer up into her face. "How can it be all right? How can it, Cookie? Maybell ain't all right. Folks say it's his fault. Folks say, I don't know. I know what folks say. But that's not going to happen to you. Trust me, child." "I can't, I can't, I can't," Queenie wailed over and over as Cookie wiped her tears and rocked her in her arms. "Ain't nobody can help me." Just then, through the screened windows of the house, they heard the tortured, mournful song of the field hands and understood that they knew what had happened. A strong, vibrant voice rang out above the others in the field and changed the song. The new melody sang their present anguish and called up beautiful scenes of Africa that were memories for those recently captured and tantalizing visions for others enslaved from birth in an alien land. "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home, a long way from home. Sometimes I feel like a moaning down. Sometimes I feel like a moaning down. Sometimes I feel like a moaning down, a long way from home, a long way from home. The song made the overseer uncomfortable. He was hated and feared by the captives, and he liked it that way. "That's why I get so much work out of their dumb black hides," he often told himself. Still, there were times when they made him feel uneasy, and this was one of those times. "Ain't no cause for nobody to be moaning round here yet," he snarled, punctuating with the resounding crack of the snakeskin whip he carried. Instantly, a lusty, powerful voice raised a rousing jubilee song. "Hallelujah, there's a meeting here tonight. Hallelujah, there's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your daily walk. There's a meeting here tonight. Get you ready, there's a meeting here tonight. Get you ready, there's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your daily walk. There's a meeting here tonight." All the hands joined in shouting the chant, improvising seemingly meaningless verses to what sounded like a nonsense song. The overseer's face relaxed into a twisted smile. "Fool niggers, always singing some pretend song about something they wish they could have. No, they ain't allowed to have no meeting where they can plot against white folks. But let them sing like fools. They work better that way." That night, recruited by the song, captives gathered at their usual meeting place. The spot was protected on one side by the river. The shore, encrusted with pebbles and rocks, made slippery, noisy footing for anyone approaching on horseback or foot, except for those traveling the hidden path that led to it, to catch or muffle sounds made during the meeting. A massive cast-iron pot was placed upside down in the area. For further protection, lookouts were placed strategically, and invisible vines strung across nearby paths to topple any rider who came too close. The meeting was emotional, filled with grief and remorse for Queenie, their child, facing a hideous fate, and for Maybelle, whom they had not been able to save. The group was overwhelmed by feelings of frustration at the surface powerlessness of their enslaved condition. Above all, they were determined that Queenie would not be next in a series of pre-adolescent enslaved girls, at least one of whom he had fathered, that Joshua Platt had ruined. The primary responsibility for finding a way to save Queenie was given to the cook and Uncle Ezra. The oldest among them, he was widely respected for his wisdom and healing knowledge. Not only was he the doctor for captives on the Johnson Plantation, his skill in curing physical ailments was sought after by people for miles around, black and white, captives and the master class alike. Within a week, the sale of Queenie was finalized, and Platt arranged for her to be brought to his place in a wheeled cart. But when Queenie was sent for, the cook said the child was sick. "What's the matter with her?" Johnson asked, surprised. "She's got a high fever. Uncle Ezra and I have been doctoring on her, but it doesn't seem to do no good so far." "Well," he paused and cleared his throat, "Mars Josh bought her, so she gonna have to go over there and stay where he is. Sick or well, don't make no difference. He'd be responsible for her getting well now." "She can't be moved," the cook said. "I told you she has a high fever. You don't want to kill the child, do you?" "Well, no. Guess if she died, he'd want his money back. But just get her over there as soon as you can." Meanwhile, behind the scenes, enslaved captives were feverishly plotting an escape to freedom for the twins. The plan was to prevent Queenie from being moved until Moses came, then put her and King on the Underground Railroad to freedom. Moses was the code name they used for Harriet Tubman, an escaped captive who kept coming back and returning other captives to freedom. But nobody knew exactly when Moses was due. Many said she was coming soon. But would it be soon enough? Could they keep the child out of Platt's hands until Moses arrived? Days passed. Platt and Johnson pressed for information about Queenie daily. They were told there was no improvement, that the child was nearly comatose, that she was being treated by Uncle Ezra. When asked about her, the old man would shake his head as though dumbfounded. "Never saw nothing like this in all my born days. Nothing I give her ain't helping." A week had passed in this way when old Judas, as the captives called Johnson secretly, summoned the cook. "Listen here," he said. "Pack that gal's things and take her over to Master Platt's today." "But I don't want to hear nothing else." He raised his hands, palms pushing outward. "I don't care if she's sick or well, if she lives or dies. She's got to go to her new master. She's his responsibility now. I don't want her dying here on my hands. She goes today." "So that's it," the cook said to Uncle Ezra in the captive's sleeping quarters shortly afterwards, her black eyes blazing angrily. "We can't stall any longer. We have to take her to Mad Dog Platt." Uncle Ezra was feeding Queenie, who ate listlessly and didn't seem to know they were there. "Always knew it could happen," he said. "Hoped it wouldn't happen before Moses got here." "What you gonna do?" the cook asked heavily. "She ain't gonna be no Maybelle over there, Ezra, if I have to take care of it myself." I know, he stroked Queenie's hair. "But ain't no cause to do what I can't change yet, not yet." He handed cook the empty dish. "Like she is now, she wouldn't stop him none," he muttered. "I have to put her down further. Even then, how can you know? You can't never know about a mad dog. Moses need to get here. Later, they wrapped a blanket around Queenie, now completely limp and unresponsive, and traveled by wagon to Platt House, where Maybell arranged for the child to share her room in the big house. "I'll be looking in on her every day," Uncle Ezra said, giving Maybell two packages of measured portions of herb powders. "Mix one from this bag in her cornmeal mush every morning. You hear Moses is coming, don't give her no more of this. Start giving her from this other bag." Their hearts heavy, Cook and Uncle Ezra climbed into the wagon and left. Inside the Platt mansion, Maybell listened to the fading sound of the horse's hooves and wagon wheels as she watched Queenie deep in sleep, her breathing heavy and labored. Slowly, she lifted Queenie's little hand in her own hands, now rough, bony, and claw-like. And she remembered the first night she had spent in this house, when her hands had been like Queenie's were now. Memories began to wash over her, how the other captives had tried to help, even tried to keep her away from Platt. In the end, nothing anybody did could stop him. They had shown her their love in countless ways, trying to comfort her tortured soul and body with soothing words and Bible quotations, with salves and ointments. She remembered the times her juvenile body had conceived, swelled, and aborted babies it was unable to carry. Then last year it had seemed she would carry a baby full term, and she had pleaded with Uncle Ezra, "Please, you've got to help me. I can't have no baby for Platt to do it like he's doing me, and I don't want to kill it after it's here. Help me now." Shortly afterwards, she had buried a stillborn daughter. Since then, ill much of the time, her insides often feeling fiery, she had not gotten pregnant again, although Platt's sexual abuse of her had not lessened. When he told her one day that he was planning to get someone to help her run the house, her heart leaped wildly. She was surprised. She hadn't seen it coming, but she knew this meant someone else would replace her in Platt's bed. Someone else would have to stand his pawing, clawing, jawing all over her body. She had not cared who that would be. She would be free of the horror, and nothing else mattered. Now, tears rolling down her face, splashing on her hands and Queenie's hands that she clutched, and the sorrow of her soul was for herself and for Queenie. She had been a little girl on the Johnson plantation when Queenie and Little King were born. Sometimes it had been her job to feed, diaper, and care for them while the grown-ups worked. For this child to replace her in Platt's mansion was unthinkable. "Never," she sobbed, rocking her tense body. "Oh, never, never." From that moment, she guarded the child fiercely, managing to always have herself or someone else in the room with her. Platt ordered that the door be kept open so he could keep abreast of Queenie's condition. Angry and afraid he had made a bad bargain, he peered through the bedroom door at Queenie, who was always asleep or stupefied. He plied Maybell and Uncle Ezra with questions and paced through the mansion.
Marion Barnes' story, Wade in the Water, continues in our next Wings program.
Thanks to Genevieve Vaughn for use of the recording studio. Find more about her work at gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. Thanks also to Suzette Cullen and community radios around the world. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.